Former Republican South Carolina Congressman Bob Inglis, who is a conservative advocate for taking meaningful actions to stop climate change, says there are reasons that conservatives often resist the common arguments for taking policy actions.
Climate change is most often presented with these kind of tones. It's going to take a bigger government to solve this. Or we've got to do with less. Or we need to sit in sackcloth and ashes. We need to repent of our evil ways. All of those things are really offensive to my tribe, right? They just don't work.
Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, former Republican Congressman from South Carolina, Bob Inglis, talks about his own climate conversion and how to talk effectively to questioning conservatives about climate change. That conversation is coming up on the show today. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Climate change is among several big issues that has become politicized and sharply polarized in recent years. Surveys on the divide of climate change acceptance show that, on average, conservative Republicans are much less likely to trust the science of climate change than liberal Democrats. But there is a small and ever-growing number of conservatives who are coming out publicly in favor of meaningful policy actions to address climate change. One of the most notable is former Republican Congressman Bob Inglis, who represented South Carolina for six terms until 2010. Inglis lost his congressional seat during the 2010 Tea Party wave, largely because of his public stance to take action on climate change. Since then, Inglis has become a vocal advocate for conservatives to accept climate science and to take meaningful actions to address it on terms that make sense for conservative values. In 2012, Inglis launched the Energy and Enterprise Initiative at George Mason University, where he promotes free enterprise action on climate change. Its website is republicen.org. That's republicen.org. For his work on climate change, he was awarded the 2015 John F. Kennedy Profile in Courage Award. He was a resident fellow at Harvard University's Institute of Politics, also a resident energy fellow at Duke University's Nicholas School in 2012, and he was a resident fellow at the University of Chicago's Institute of Politics in 2014. Today we're airing former Congressman Inglis's talk at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, recorded back on November 3rd. He spoke to an audience of students about what it's been like to have conservative values and want to take meaningful action on climate change. He also speaks about how to speak effectively to conservatives about climate change in ways that resonate with them. Inglis begins his talk today by taking a cell phone survey of the audience in the room.
I may be this unusual zoo animal, you know, an actual conservative who's concerned about climate change. But here's the thing. I think we're reproducing and we are replicating. The thing is, we need to replicate very rapidly in order to solve this challenge that we've got. But before I say much more, I think I want to not poison the sample with anything I say. I want to have you tell me a little bit about yourselves. So if you have your cell phone, Hope just told you to turn off your cell phone, but now you need to turn on your cell phone to help me with this, because I'm going to ask you. We're going to find out something about you. If you have a cell phone with you, here's what I want you to do. Text eco-right. That's what we are at republicen.org. We're the eco-right. We're balanced to the environmental left, all right? So text the word eco-right, E-C-O-R-I-G-H-T, to 22333. And then you will be connected. And the NSA is going to gather all of the data off of your phone. And I'm going to know all about you. Actually, not. That last part, I hope, is a joke. I don't know about poll everywhere. You know, who knows? Maybe they are connected in. So then what I want you to do, once you connect to EcoWright at 22333, text EcoWright to 22333, then you'll be given a screen that gives you an opportunity to tell us where, just to give me a word for where you are on the political spectrum. This is free form. You can be anything you want to be. You know, anarchist, socialist, libertarian, right winger, you can be whatever you want to put you, however you want to self-describe yourself. Oh, we got an independent, and this word cloud will build for us, and we'll find out mostly who we've got here. I'm liking the fact, oh, conservative is big. This is really helpful. This is good to me. This is good. But you're welcome, whatever word you want to put up there. So we've got a Madisonian authoritarian. Now, that's interesting. We've got a Federalist, an anarchist. We do. We got a scientist. We got a right winger. Good. We got a few liberals, apparently. just kidding. That one's getting large. We've got libertarians. I'm not sure what it is. We had a rational person. I like how the word cloud has put rational right wing together right there for a second. Okay, so we've got liberal is fairly large, conservative is pretty big too. This is pretty exciting for me because we're talking especially to conservatives here. Maybe if I combine the libertarians, the Republican, and the conservative, we'd even take that liberal. What do you think? Okay, so if I force you into binary choice to identify as either a Republican or B Democrat, tell me which you'd be. 77% Democrats here, forcing you to identify. 75, 25. Early returns are still coming in. Oh, look at that! I'm excited about this. We've just risen to 27. Come in if you're a Republican. Just kidding. No, okay, so we got about 26% Republicans and 74% Democrats. Okay, now, are you A, persuaded by the evidence that climate change is real and human-caused, or are you B, not certain because you don't think the science is clear enough? And really, either answer is fine. I want you to know, especially if I look up there and see some bees, I'm very happy because that means I'm not preaching to the converted, all right? So if you're a bee, you are most welcome. I'm going to come sit with you. I'm going to go to dinner with you tonight. I'm going to come to your house. Okay, good. So we got some bees. That tells me that I'm talking to some people that, you know, it's the rule of sales is if you make the sale, stop talking, right? And so if I looked up there and it was 100% A, then I should really stop talking. Okay, so 12% of you think it's maybe the science isn't clear enough yet. So that's good. We're going to be talking with you. Okay, so give me one word for the impacts of climate change. It'd be interesting to see how this word cloud develops. It could be, you know, that you think it's fake news if you're one of those 12%. It could be that you think it's overblown, or you could say, tell me it's devastating, catastrophic, you know. So we got an over-exaggerated, we got a devastating is really big. Apocalyptic, sad, preventable, I like that word. We get somebody saying natural, somebody saying misery, depressing, emergency, cautionary, I like that. Lucrative, I'm into that word. That is pretty exciting. Somebody's thinking my way about how this is an opportunity, not just a danger. Inequality, that's surely the case. We've got poor people who are going to be most affected by climate change, particularly in undeveloped countries. It is gross, I agree, especially since the background of that screen is a dead coral. So if you're into scuba diving, do you really want to scuba dive through a cemetery? Or would you rather scuba dive through something that's alive? Okay, so devastating looks like the biggest word we got up there that you're telling me about climate change. Okay, the next one, when climate change is mentioned, give me the last name of the first person who comes to mind. The name of the person who comes to mind when you think about climate change, last name only. Interesting, we got Tillerson up there, and we got, I want to talk to that person, because that's a really interesting answer. I've never gotten a Tillerson on the screen. And I'll just drop a footnote there. You know that Rex Tillerson, as recently as October of 2016, as CEO of ExxonMobil, was making a speech in which he was advocating for a carbon tax. Darren Woods, his successor CEO, as his very first blog post, reiterated the company's position that they are in favor of a carbon tax. We did a little Valentine's card delivery on Capitol Hill last Valentine's Day. Roses are red, snowballs are white, together we get the solutions right. And so the cover-up was a Russell Stover box with roses on it. Roses are red. Open it up, snowballs are white. There's a picture of Jim Inhofe, Senator Jim Inhofe, throwing the snowball on the Senate floor. And then together we get the solutions right, check the reverse for the backside for a sweet solution from Rex Tillerson. This card was delivered along with actual snowballs, the Hostess cake confection, chemical confection. You've had one. It's chemicals and some coconut. Guaranteed to preserve you. You don't need embalming if you eat enough of those. Anyway, so we delivered all these snowballs around Capitol Hill with that card. Okay, so I just think that's interesting that Tillerson showed up there. Okay, so as expected, Al Gore turns out to be the main name up there, right? The largest name. The other thing that's interesting is this is the about, I've been on the road now doing this, we're in this Encourage tour where we're going 10 cities, 10 weeks. And it's been interesting that Trump has been coming up pretty close to Gore, which it's just interesting that that's who people are thinking about when they think of climate change. Perhaps as the opponent and the proponent, huh? Okay, so thanks. That's very helpful. Now, enough said about you. Let's talk about me some. I once said that on a date. Thank goodness she knew I was joking because she's been my wife for 35 years now. So, but anyway, I wouldn't suggest it. Don't say to a date that enough said about you. Let's talk about me some. But, okay, so I found out some about you, right? Now, I'll tell you who it is in the world is talking to you. You know, you go outside your district, nobody knows who you are. There was once an arrogant senator who was on a healthcare mission. He was in a nursing home, and he was walking along, you know, in sort of great arrogance. We in the House think that senators need to travel with three people. House members usually travel with just one person. The three are there to contain the ego of the senator is what we figure. But anyway, so the senator's making his way down the nursing home hallway, and some lady, the resident, demands some water from him. Give me some water. The senator looks back at her and says, "Ma'am, do you know who I am?" And she, who had been demanding, turned strangely compassionate and said, "No, but if you go to the front desk, they'll tell you." Anyway, so if you go outside your district, nobody knows who in the world you are. So let me explain who in the world was in politics, right? Okay, so I represent the Greenville-Spartanburg area in the U.S. Congress for 6 years. Probably the reddest district and the reddest state in the nation. I can say that in a lot of places, but I'm not sure I can say it in Utah. You know, if I'm in Massachusetts or something, I usually say, "You want to fight me for that distinction?" But I think I could lose here in Utah. I mean, you may be redder than I am. I was recently in Idaho on this tour. I pulled that punch, too, because I'm not sure I could compete. But we're pretty doggone conservative in Greenville-Spartanburg, right? And so that was my first 6 years of Congress with me saying climate change was nonsense. I didn't know anything about it, except that Al Gore was for it. And so I admit that's fairly ignorant, but that's the way it was, right, for 6 years. Then I was out of Congress for 6 years doing commercial real estate law. I was running for Congress again in 04. My son, who just turned 18, the eldest of our five kids, was voting for the first time. And so he came to me and said, "Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment." It's the first of a three-step metamorphosis for me. By the way, he was clearly going to vote for me. It was not a threat. People write that up all the time as it was a threat that my son was not going to vote for me. It was not in his economic interest to vote against me, all right? I mean, it would have been really a bad move if we'd lost by one vote. So Robert was going to vote for me no matter what. What he's really saying was, "Dad, I love you, and you can be better than you were before, so how about let's make this English 2.0, the new and improved version?" And so that was step one of this three-step metamorphosis. The second step was going to Antarctica with the Science Committee. You're going to get a fun fact to know and tell here today that the ski conditions at the South Pole are described this way: a mile of ice and a couple inches of powder. A little bit different than your ski conditions, I suppose. So in that mile of ice at the South Pole that sits on top of a mile of dirt, so it's 10,000 feet above sea level, in the mile of ice is an amazing record of the Earth's atmosphere. And so the scientists drill down through the ice, take the cores up, put them in coolers and fly them to Ohio State where they put them in these big freezers. And then we study the level of greenhouse gases trapped in that ice. And what we see is this stability followed by this uptick in coinciding with the Industrial Revolution. And I'm not a scientist. Let me give you some practical political advice. Don't say that in a Republican primary, because that is a really bad answer. The polling data on that is miserable, even though my friend John Boehner was using it for a while and some others were saying, I'm not a scientist, therefore I don't know about climate change. It's almost as bad as saying, I'm not a truck driver, therefore I have no position on road funding. I'm not a doctor, therefore I have no position on healthcare. You know, the idea is, no, we want you to go study up and figure out what your position might should be on those things. That was a Southernism, by the way. I just let slip, might, should. Did you hear that? We say that thing in the South. So in that ice, we have this record of the Earth's atmosphere, and it shows this uptick with the Industrial Revolution. And isn't that just apparent? Correlation does not equal causation, but doesn't it just make sense that if we go deep into the Earth and pull up vegetation that's been going a long time, and it's now fossil fuels, coal, petroleum, natural gas, and we burn it, we're changing the chemistry of the air. I'll tell you, if you're one of those 12% that were up there, don't object yet, because your chemistry professor is in the room and you will get an F if you object to that, because that's, you can't object to that. I'll tell you when you can object. So you change the chemistry of the air by burning these fossil fuels, creating a great deal of CO2. Then the physics of light are such that light enters, but all the radiant heat doesn't escape, right? Thank goodness. We get this wonderful layer of greenhouse gases, and it moderates our temperature. And so, again, don't object here, because your physics professor is here, and they will give you an F, because that physics has been known since the 1800s. And so now here's where you can object. The modeling as to what will happen 100 or 200 years from now, you can object all day long to that, because it's really, you know, you can pull parts of it and you can say, we're not sure about that. But in the main, what it shows is a storm is coming. Exactly where it's going to land, that's harder to predict. It's sort of like, you know, with all eyes on Irma, the modeling first showed it going as a Category 5 straight at Miami. And then the last 24 hours, it shifted 50 miles to the west. It's called dodging a bullet for the American economy, because if it had hit Miami head on, I was just down there on this tour with the mayor of Miami, who told me that the CEO of the power company there told him that if it's a dead-on hit to Miami, we'll be down for 6 months rebuilding the grid, because it's just unprecedented. But he expected to be 6 months closing. So we went to Naples. Bad for Naples, but probably good for the American economy. It didn't hit Miami straight on. Okay, so that's modeling in the same, right, with your eyes on it, and it's still difficult, right? So if you want to object to the modeling about climate impacts 100 or 200 years from now, you'd be right to do so at this point. Say, well, how can we be sure? But of course, the response is, the storm's coming.
Bob Inglis is a former Republican congressman from South Carolina. He spoke about his conversion into a conservative who accepts the science of climate change and how he became an advocate for policy actions to address it. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCBW. We'll return to his talk in a moment.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts of more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah, and we replay them in their entirety as a public service. Today, we are broadcasting a talk given a few weeks ago by former South Carolina Congressman Bob Inglis. He is a conservative advocate for taking urgent actions to address global climate change. During his talk, he spoke about what he describes as his own three-step metamorphosis into a conservative who accepts climate change and the series of steps that he took to get there.
Okay, so that's what I saw in second step of this metamorphosis was that trip to Antarctica and seeing the evidence in the ice core drillings. Third step was another science committee trip and a spiritual awakening on that trip, which is impossible, right? I mean, how could you have a spiritual awakening on a godless science committee trip? Apparently, all scientists are not godless, because this Aussie climate scientist was showing me the glories of the reef. We were snorkeling together, and he'd go down, he'd show me something, he'd come to the surface, and he'd be all excited. You could see it in his voice, or you'd hear it in his voice, you could see it in his eyes, all over his face, that he was worshiping God in what he was showing me. It was clear to me that he wasn't worshiping the creation. His mother isn't the earth. He has a mother. It's not the earth. He was not worshiping Mother Earth, but he was worshiping the God of creation that created all of that. And I could tell we shared a worldview without any words being spoken, because, you know, St. Francis of Assisi said, preach the gospel at all times. If necessary, use words. So Scott Heron was preaching the gospel, and I heard it. Later, we had a chance to talk, and he told me about conservation changes he's making in his life in order to love God and love people. Scott rides his bike to work. He tries to do without air conditioning in Townsville, Australia, which is hard to do. It's a hot place. He does all these things to consciously love people come after us. So I was real inspired by that. I want to be like Scott, loving God and loving people. So I came home and introduced the Raise Wages, Cut Carbon Act of 2009. Note to self, do not introduce carbon tax in midst of great recession in reddest district of reddest state of nation. It will not go well for you, and it did not go well at all. After 12 years in Congress, I got 29% of the vote, and the other guy got 71% of the vote. So that's what we call in politics a spectacular face plant. It's why I sort of wanted Rick Perry to run for president and get elected, because I figure if you can overcome, I mean, eliminate one, two, if you can forget the third and come back, then maybe even I could come back. But anyway, so at that point, you know, after my face plant, a foundation came to me and said, you know, Inglis, you're an unusual zoo animal, an actual conservative who says climate change is real. And of course, actual conservative, I should substantiate that. 93 American Conservative Union rating. Is that an A here at Utah? 93? It's an A? So it's sort of a low A, but it's still an A, right? So 93 American Conservative Union rating, 100% Christian Coalition, 100% National Right to Life, A with the NRA, zero with the Americans for Democratic Action, 23 by some mistake with the AFL-CIO. I was really hoping for a zero. So pretty conservative guy, right? So they said, an actual conservative who says climate change is real, will you speak and write for the proposition? So I said, well, the cage is nice and the food's good. So the cage, as I said earlier, is very nice. I'm here in Salt Lake City. It's a beautiful place to be, and the food is pretty good. The pizza's been pretty good. So that's what I'm doing now. I get three folks in D.C., one in Wisconsin, two of us live and work from South Carolina, and we're out to convince conservatives to engage on climate change. And we do that by talking to them in different ways than they're used to hearing climate change. Climate change is most often presented with these kind of tones. It's going to take a bigger government to solve this. Or we've got to do with less. Or we need to sit in sackcloth and ashes. We need to repent of our evil ways. All of those things are really offensive to my tribe. Right? They just don't work. They've also heard that China and India are going to keep on doing it, so why would it make any difference for us to change? And so what we live to do is to answer all of those things with different language to help conservatives to see that this is their cause and that they can feel pretty good about engaging in the conversation. We think there are two things that keep conservatives out of the conversation. One is an undeserved inferiority complex. Conservatives apparently think they're no good when it comes to energy and climate. And so when the topic comes up, they want to shrink in science denial because they don't think they're any good at the conversation. So what we live to do is to say to them, no, you're very good. You know the answer. And the answer comes from people who have who are the famous among conservatives. For example, this fellow, Milton Friedman. This is a clip of Milton Friedman on the Phil Donahue show in the 80s. Now, there's some people old enough here to remember who Phil Donahue was, but let me explain for everybody else. He's basically a white guy doing an Oprah. And he was from Chicago, and that's where they did the show from. And that's what, so he used to have Dr. Friedman on, who was a University of Chicago economics professor, Reagan advisor, father of the earned income tax credit, and proponent of something called a negative income tax. He's rock solid conservative. Every time he appeared on television, he wore an Adam Smith tie. That's his Adam Smith tie that he's got on right there. And so we go around as republican.org showing conservatives this from Dr. Friedman.
There is a case for doing something about pollution, but the way we've been going about it is the wrong way.
Is there a case for the government to do something
about it? Yes, there is a case for the government to do something about it, because there's always a case for the government to some extent when what two people do affects a third party. There's no case for the government whatsoever in mandating airbags, because airbags protect the people inside the car. That's my business. If I want to protect myself, I should do it at my expense. But there is a... But there is a case for the government protecting third parties, protecting people who have not voluntarily agreed to enter. So there's more of a case, for example, for emission control than there is for airbags. Mm-hmm. But the question is, what's the best way to do it? And the best way to do it is not to have bureaucrats in Washington write rules and regulations saying that a car has to carry this, that, or the other. The best way to do it is to impose a tax on the amount of pollutants emitted by a car and make it in the self-interest of the car manufacturers and of the consumers to keep down the amount of pollution in that way.
But how would you put a monetary value on particulate matter which is emitted from the end of an exhaust pipe?
You do it now. What do you mean, how do you do it? You now require people to spend something like $500 per car for the purpose, supposedly, of reducing particulate matter, which means for the purpose of giving them an incentive to disconnect the equipment that's supposed to reduce pollution.
You mean the owner does?
So let me give you some historical context. People of my age will remember what he's talking about there. The catalytic converter, people used to disconnect those from the car. It would get better gas mileage, but you'd pollute the air. And so that's what he's joking about. And isn't it fascinating that the airbag thing created some applause from a little band of libertarian or conservatives that were there with Dr. Friedman at the Phil Donahue show? That's sort of interesting. So what we this first thing we do for conservatives is help them to see that you're not inferior, that you've got a real tradition of people who have thought this through and who are on whose shoulders we stand to say, you know what, it makes sense to tax pollution, because by taxing pollution, you're adding the cost of that product that it's causing to society. You're putting it on the product. So then the marketplace can judge that product. And so that's one thing we tell conservatives. The second thing we tell them is we understand why it is that you have been hesitant to enter this conversation, because it's something called solution aversion is what we think is going on. Is it, you know, solution aversion is a term you might have learned in psychology about how it is that if we don't think there's a solution available to us, we doubt the existence of the problem. And that sounds irrational until I tell you, here's a plan of back surgery for that problem, or the plan of surgery for that back problem you're having. First, we're going to take your head off. After we get your head off, we can work on your spine, then we're going to put your head back on. Thanks, doc, I'm feeling a lot better. I don't have a back problem, right? The solution is nuts. You're not going to take my head off. And so think about it. If you're a progressive here, think about it way that conservatives have heard so far about climate change and how your Uncle Charlie, who's coming to Thanksgiving dinner with you, has heard about this. This is what he's heard on Fox and Friends. He's heard that the godless scientist, they're not all godless, it's just evidenced by the fact of Scott Herod in Australia, but the godless scientists got together with the UN bureaucrats. They looped in the Wall Street traders, and they came up with this monstrosity called cap and trade. And so, something I voted against, by the way, and proposed that alternative. They got me in a lot of trouble. And then, when that failed, the secret Muslim non-American socialist, he's none of those things, but you know that's what Charlie heard. The secret Muslim non-American socialist came up with the Clean Power Plan, which was the idea to regulate Charlie's very breath. And so do you understand why Charlie is thinking, we must not have a problem? Because the solution is nuts. You're not going to grow the government to regulate my life, to take away liberty, to grow the nanny state. You're just not going to do it. And so that's what Charlie's heard so far. And so what we go to Charlie and to the 16% of the conservatives who were up on that screen is to say, no, we're not going to do that. We're actually going to have a slightly smaller government. Because if we do this carbon tax, and look at there, I mentioned the word and the ground is still did not swallow me up. I said it yesterday at BYU and the ground did not swallow me either. Not even there. It didn't swallow me. If we do this carbon tax and pair it with a dollar-for-dollar reduction in existing taxes or a dividend of all that revenue back to the citizens, there's no growth of government. So, Charlie, we're not growing the government. In fact, we're getting a slightly smaller government because some Clean Air Act regulations, just a few of them, could be repealed because of the proxy pricing of dealing with those pollutants through the price on carbon dioxide. So it's a slightly smaller government. And to the objection that he's heard on Fox and Friends, that China is going to keep on doing this, it's border adjustable. And so what that means is that we would apply the tax on entry of goods into the United States. And so when they enter, so for example, right now there's a sheet of flat steel coming through the port of Seattle from a Chinese state-run industry. We would apply the tax at the port of Seattle. The money would be sent to Washington. China would object in the World Trade Organization saying that's an impermissible tariff. We think they lose that case based on precedents in the chemical industry. If we're right and they do lose in the WTO, within 24 hours, because they have amazing ways of reaching consensus in China, within 24 hours, they would have the same price on carbon dioxide. Why? Because they're paying a tax on entry into the United States that's going to Washington that if they had just imposed the tax in China, they would have sent the money to Beijing. So 24 hours later, they got the same price on carbon dioxide. And then you've got 7 billion people around the world responding to Milton Friedman's price signal, seeing the true cost of energy and responding, demanding innovation, looking for better solar cells, looking for better batteries, driving innovation. And now I got to tell you, that what you just heard was a faith statement, all right? That was a faith statement in free enterprise. And I tell you that not everybody shares my faith in free enterprise. I was on with Naomi Klein one time. Naomi does not share my faith in free enterprise. I will tell you that Naomi is making a very fine living in the capitalistic system, attacking capitalism. She's living far better than I am, I will tell you. She's making a very fine living in the capitalistic system. But so she doesn't share my view, but I am here to tell you that free enterprise can do it. And the proof is the thing that you were using earlier on my poll everywhere question. that phone that is in your pocket is quite affordable, apparently, because we all have them, or most of us have them. My first phone, cell phone, was a bag phone. We got it for the 1992 campaign. It was in a bag, and I'm seeing some people that are old enough to remember what a bag phone was. It's in a bag, and it had a cord on it. I'm looking at students, and they're thinking, what in the world is he talking about? Really, you'd pick the phone up, and it had a cord on it, and you would speak into it. And the three counties in the district I represented, it didn't work in one of them. The battery didn't last very long, and it cost about $1 a minute to talk on the thing. And there were these things called roaming charges and long-distance charges. Long distance, you had to pay if you're going to a different area code. I mean, you can go and learn these things in a museum somewhere, or talk to an old guy like me, right, about how this used to work. So think about this, my faith in free enterprise. McKinsey, the famous consulting firm that some of you may go to work for, I guess, was asked in the 1980s by AT&T to tell AT&T how many cell phones would be in use when Y2K rolled around. AT&T was deciding whether to go whole hog into cellular technology. McKinsey studied and studied, and they reported back, 800,000. When Y2K rolled around, there were 800,000 cell phones going into service every 3 days. McKinsey had missed it by some mathematician here could tell me how many orders of magnitude McKinsey missed that by, right? Now, in fairness to McKinsey, the batteries weren't any good. The service wasn't any good. It was very expensive. And so no wonder they came up with 800,000. Or another example about substantiating my faith in free enterprise. 10 years ago, Mr. Bezos was selling books. That's all. Now he's selling you everything you want. He'd probably even sell you a house somehow on Amazon. And he's running a lot of web services, right? So that's what free enterprise does. And so I can understand there's some people who would say, no, here's what we got to do. And if my friend Bill McKibbeny is a wonderful guy, if he were here, he'd say, cap it at 350, regulate down to that. It's a scientific problem, solve it by regulation. That's a respectable view. It's just that it won't scratch on the right. There's nobody on the right that will accept that solution. And so that's why we think that free enterprise is the way to talk about this. Now, if you're a progressive here, if you're among the majority here that are progressive in this audience, and what I'm talking about here sounds somewhat familiar, it's because it's exactly what Al Gore has been for 30 years now. Al Gore has always been for a revenue-neutral, border-adjustable carbon tax as the solution to climate change. And he believes, apparently, as I do, that innovation will happen rapidly. And so, in fact, the bill that I had, that Raise Wages, Cut Carbon Act of 2009, was really exactly Al Gore's idea. Because the corresponding tax cut to use the revenue from the carbon tax was a payroll tax reduction. And the reason for that is it addresses the regressivity problem of a carbon tax. A carbon tax by itself is regressive. It hurts poor people. Because poor people drive older cars, they have less energy efficient homes, less insulated homes, and so it hits poor people harder. But the payroll tax hits poor people hardest of all. It is the most regressive tax we've got. The janitor of this building pays a whopping 12.4% tax on the first dollar of income. 6.2 that shows up on their check, 6.2 that the university pays that doesn't show up on his or her paycheck. It's 12.4%. And so if you reduce that tax and put on a carbon tax, the Congressional Budget Office says the bottom 70 percentile do better in America than they're doing now because it untaxes income.
Coming up, former Congressman Bob Inglis takes questions from the audience of students. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts of more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today we're broadcasting a recent talk given at the Hinckley Institute of Politics by former Republican Congressman Bob Inglis from South Carolina. He talks about his own transformation into a conservative Republican who advocates for climate action, even though it cost him his seat in Congress in 2010. He is currently the executive director of the Energy and Enterprise Initiative at George Mason University, and he visited the University of Utah a few weeks ago as part of a speaking tour.
My name is Derek Thomas. Let me just say first, I've been a Democrat for the last 10 years, but I've never met a Republican that put his case as persuasively as you. Well done. But I have a question. If free enterprise is supposed to be the great American pastime, supposed to be the great American opportunity that we're so famous for, then how come access to capital is such a restriction? For example, I can't go out and start a burger shop tomorrow. I have debt. I've been going to college for about 5 years. And where would I even get that kind of capital? I mean, for example, banks don't give startup loans. So I feel like access to capital is one of the major restrictions in free enterprise doing what you say it does. What are your thoughts about that?
That's true. What do we do about it? The next question, so you want me to address the student loan problem? I don't know what we do about that. I think that's the issue, right? Is that's what's restraining your situation is existing debt, right? I will tell you, I think that it is an issue, and I'm now going to step on the toes of some administrator who might be here, is it's a real question about why colleges and universities cost so much. I've got five kids. We got one right now. They got their mother's intelligence, and they're going to really expensive places. We've got a sweep arrangement. You know, I was a commercial real estate lawyer. There's a sweep arrangement. You know, that's where the bank sweeps the money and goes off to your creditor, right? Every morning they take the money out of the account. We've got that with Duke University right now. They just sweep the account every day, and every dime that's in there, they take. And so I can identify. But also got to believe that education is probably the best investment you can make. So it's worth incurring some debt for it. That's now the administrator's feeling a little bit better about me being here maybe, But it's a classic thing that's always been is how do you get access to the capital, and you got to have a really good idea and somebody that's willing to take a risk on you, right? That's what you got to have. I will tell you, I got a daughter who's working something on it, which is a system of an app, a financial device that makes it easier for banks to make loans. That may sound like, well, Inglis, what a terrible idea! Get more people in interest rate bondage. Well, actually what it is a way if a bank could bank small loans, there'd be less payday lenders. We're not talking about you, we're talking about really hard-pressed folks who go to payday lenders and pay, we're talking four-digit, sometimes five-digit interest rates if you do it on an annual rate. And so the reason that they have to go those places is there is no bank that will bank small loans because the transaction costs at the front end are too big for the bank. And so this app would reduce those transaction costs, make it more possible for people to get loans quickly. But I'm admitting that's a problem, but I don't, it's not a problem that's unique to climate change, certainly, and not something that we're going to deal with in this particular bill. Yes, sir.
Hello, so my name is Quaid Green, and I'm currently a fairly left-leaning, I like to say moderate, but I am left-leaning, and I side more with the Democratic Party, but I was raised by conservatives, staunch conservatives. My father is that way, and all of his friends are that way.
Yeah.
And every time we would go camping when I was young, they would talk about this, and they would say exactly the same things that you did in your presentation about Obama and about climate change and those types of things. And I remember several conversations where they discussed things like a carbon tax. And they always said, no matter what I said, or even back when I tended to agree with them, they always said that if the government taxed carbon, that businesses would just roll those costs over onto the consumers and nothing would ever change about that. And I'm certainly not a tax expert. I wouldn't say they are either. So I'm just wondering, when we are talking to conservative friends and family, and they come at us with rebuttals like that, what do you say? How do you explain to them that that's not how this is going to work, and that it's actually going to solve the problem or help solve the problem?
Yeah. Well, of course, it is there. In part true about the correct about the effect is that businesses will pass those costs on to consumers. That's exactly what we want them to do, of course, because we all want to see the actual cost of energy. If we do, then that causes us in the liberty of enlightened self-interest to go looking for an alternative, right? I mean, if I tell you that, that it's the competitive system, right? If I can offer you the same service for a slightly lower price, you'll come to me and you'll leave my competitor in the dust, right? And so that's what, right now, what we've got is the alternative for fossil fuels are some renewables that have to be propped up with various subsidies, one of which has been impaired in the last 24 hours in the release of my party's tax plan. Wind is going to be disadvantaged, and a deal that they thought they had is now maybe going away. And so wind and solar and those live in mortal fear of a change in the tax code, right? And so we prop them up because fossil fuels aren't fully accountable. You make fossil fuels accountable and then pass that cost on to me, the consumer, and then I start seeing that cost and I move away from that price signal. So what I'd suggest is show your dad that Milton Friedman clip. Just search Friedman and Donahue and you'll find it. Perhaps that'll help him to see, no, it really will work. Chris, you got the microphone, yeah?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Bob, first, thank you very much. Great talk.
Yeah.
Two questions. One, are there any other countries around that have employed a carbon tax like this, some examples that are out there? Secondly, can you talk a little bit about what's going on in Congress with the Climate Solutions Caucus, something that I'm sure you wish was around when you were back
yeah.
in Congress?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, so British Columbia has a carbon tax in place that seems to be working quite well. It's a province in Canada. And Australia has had a carbon tax and not had a carbon tax and had a carbon tax and not had a carbon tax. And in fact, it's been part of the flipping of some prime ministers in Australia. And I had this wonderful opportunity to go to Australia because the Australia Institute wanted a conservative American to come try to convince Australian conservatives to act on climate change. And it's very interesting to see the difference between them and us. Australia is a teeny part of the world economy. And so they really can't do what I was describing earlier about saying, we're going to lead and the rest of the world is going to end up following. Because if you're Australia and you impose a border adjustable carbon tax, there are just not many, I mean, you just don't have the market power to do it. The United States is the market that everybody wants access to. And so if we impose a carbon tax and say, bring your stuff in, fine, it's just going to pay our carbon tax, then it causes them to go do the same. So that's the difference between us and them. In the case of British Columbia, it's worked well as a province. So there's some state initiatives, too, in the United States. Hopefully we can do it at the federal level, though, because if you don't do it at the federal level, you can't do the border adjustment. A state under the U.S. Constitution cannot impose a tariff. So it's very important to perhaps experiment in states where we love the conversation going on there, but we need to do this at the federal level.
Hi, my name is Lucia. I'm a liberal.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if you could give some solid numbers, like what exactly you propose, and then also what the difference is between your plan and what Al Gore proposed is, because if it's the same, then how do you think that you're appealing more to conservatives than he did? Thank you.
So that second one first, it's just that we're using a language of conservatism, which would be different than his language. But it's the same proposal. Here's some numbers for you. My bill was $15 a ton, rising to $100 a ton over 30 years' time, paired with a cut in payroll taxes, 15 to 100 over 30 years. But most people are talking sort of about $25 or $40 per ton on price of carbon dioxide. applied presumably at the mine and at the pipeline. The beauty of that is administrative simplicity. It's, there are only 2,000 taxpayers in the United States who either mine coal or put stuff in a pipeline. So the IRS could do it in a room this size. I mean, they could impose that tax in a, from a room this size. It's a very small job for the IRS. And so a $25 per ton price on carbon dioxide turns into 25 cents a gallon when you get to the end of that pipeline and you're buying gasoline at the gas station. It causes your gas to go up by 25 cents a gallon. It causes your electricity to go up by 1 to 2 cents per kilowatt hour. And I will tell you that I should disclose this to you here in Utah. You're a little bit bad off on that because you're 80% coal, and so you'll be at the toward the high end of that range. If you're South Carolina, which is 50% nuclear, thank goodness, we'd be in pretty good shape. If you're Washington State, you're in great shape because you got so much hydro, you won't even notice that your electric bill went up. So, but that's the order of magnitude. Some people are talking about a $40 per ton price on carbon dioxide. You know, here with a number of friends from Citizens Climate Lobby, they're talking really sort of about a $40 per ton price. That turns into about a $500 per quarter check back to the family. So you put on the $40 per ton carbon tax, it generates money, you dividend that back like the Alaska Permanent Fund, and you get a check in the mail, your family gets a check in the mail for $500 a quarter. Steadily rising. And so next quarter, or you know, 2 years from now, it might be $520 your family is getting every quarter. And that helps with the regressive part of that as well, because then a poor person is getting that check and they're able to afford some of that energy cost. Of course, the problem is, let me tell you, the real problem with this politically is that there are many people who do not believe that we will cut taxes somewhere else or dividend the money back after we put on the carbon tax. They just don't believe it. And that is a problem that we've got to overcome, not just conservatives, not just liberals. We got to all overcome the fact that there's just this lack of trust. Now, of course, there's plenty of evidence for it. Probably got a bridge or two here in Utah, perhaps, or an expressway that's been tolled, and the idea is once it's paid for, the toll will come off, and the toll keeps on going. Or the education lottery in states like mine. Oh, we're going to save education with this education lottery. But then the legislature cuts funding for education to about to the level of the education lottery funds, so it didn't do anything, right? So we have, the evidence is replete that we can't trust the government to do this. But somehow we got to break that distrust and say, no, if it's not in the bill that it's going to be immediately returned, don't vote for it. And so if it's not on the four corners of the bill, don't vote for it. What else do you want to know? Questions or comments here?
So, my name is Eliza Stauffer. Excuse me, Eliza Stauffer.
Yeah.
I'm a registered Republican, but I'm a bit more moderate than that might imply. But my question to you is, if we were able to pass this carbon tax, what is to keep companies from simply leaving or doing their operations in other countries that don't have that carbon tax?
Great question. That's the key to the border adjustment. It's got to be there. If I were still in Congress and you gave me a revenue-neutral carbon tax, in other words, cut taxes somewhere else, put on a carbon tax, but it weren't border adjustable, I wouldn't vote for it because I represented a wonderful manufacturing district. We make BMWs in Spartanburg, South Carolina. It's got to be border adjustable because that means that, and this was what was wrong with the Clean Power Plan. The Clean Power Plan would have caused American energy to go to its truer costs through a fairly clumsy process of regulation through the Clean Air Act. But that would have caused manufacturers to pick up and move, just like you just said, to China, let's say, because of the relative cost of energy. In other words, they can go to China and get cheaper energy because China isn't accountable, let's say. If we make ourselves accountable and the rest of the world isn't, you create this incentive to pick up and move. Well, here's the problem with moving. You lose the jobs, obviously, but maybe not so obvious, you lose the race, and we believe it is a race to reduce emissions, because once you pick up and move that manufacturing to China, they can emit more there than they were emitting here, because China is way more energy inefficient than we are. And so the result is you lose the race. Now, if President Obama were here with us today, he would say to me this. He'd say, Inglis, if you had 25 House Republicans ready to vote for what you've just described to these people, and 15 Senate Republicans, I would have switched to you and Al Gore's plan in a skinny minute. But you don't have them. And that's why I had to do the Clean Power Plan. And he'd be exactly correct about that. But what we live to do at RepublicEN.org is to build the support so there are eventually 25 House Republicans and 15 Senate Republicans ready to vote for that price on carbon dioxide so that we can do that deal and bring progressives and conservatives together to solve it. And by the way, if I could add just a little bit about the, you're not asking, but the Paris Accord is a, we're really very disappointed at RepublicEN.org. I mean, if you check my Twitter feed, you'll find out, I hope I'm not offending the Republicans here, but I was very early on an ever-Trumper and remain of that affect. And so so we're aghast that he pulled the United States out of Paris. Not that Paris establishes a way to get it done, but it does establish a will to get it done. And I just got to say, it's a strange place for my country to be sniveling on the sidelines about how this is unfair for us, along with Syria, the only other country on the sidelines. I mean, it's not what I think of as the United States' role in the world. My idea of the United States' role in the world is leading the charge down the field to figure out how to get this done. That's us. And somehow, the temporarily grumpy old party that I hope returns to be in the Grand Opportunity Party is out there to basically defend buggy whip manufacturers and hold on to coal and fossil fuels, the technologies of the last century, as though that's all we've got. Where did that become the affect of my party? My party is the one that says, we are going to lead the future. We are going to invent the future. We're not going to be the people who hold on to buggy whip manufacturers. So the standard line in trade disputes or just trade debates in Congress has always been that the Democrats, the liberals, are trying to protect existing industries. And the conservative line has always been, we can't help you if you're making buggy whips. When Henry Ford invents the car, we're moving on. And so that's our normal affect as conservatives. We've got a temporary nationalist populist thing that is not conservatism. And so go ahead, Bob. Tell us what you really think. Don't hold back. Anyway, so hope, am I out of time? You can give me the hook here? Or
unfortunately, we're all out of time for questions. If you have any questions, you're welcome to go up afterwards, grab some more pizza while you're at it. Please join me in thanking Bob Inglis for an interesting and informative forum.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Bob Inglis is a former Republican congressman from South Carolina. He spoke about his personal conversion into a conservative who accepts the science of climate change and how to advocate with conservative arguments for policy actions to address the climate crisis. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss. Thanks for listening.